June to the date requested by the person that inspired the bill. And so you are going to have to change your rates. Some employers are going to have higher rates, some are going to have lower rates. We don't know how many, apparently, or you don't know how many. What would be the bottom line? I wasn't kidding about, are you saying the governor would veto the bill if we did that?
I have not talked to the governor, nor has Ray Thorne, on this specific bill or that specific amendment. I merely mentioned that because that had been a matter of discussion on other bills where retroactive provisions were provided.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, just one other
question.
Libby, could we use 1982 as the year to roll back, but provide one other exception for those particular cases that where the employers had come in to appeal to go back to 81?
I saw what they did to it.
Well, actually, that's what you're doing in the law as written up in the House amendments, where it says 1982. The employer has to come in and ask for the relief of charges. So if you just change the date to 1981, it would be the same thing. The employer would still have to come in and ask. The employer would be notified that such an opportunity existed for him to ask for relief, and would come in then and ask at his volition.
It's not possible to create a window?
That might be a good idea. Get so much time. Couldn't have that big an impact on shifting the rates.
In other words, if we were to, in mailing out notices this, what is it, November, Roger?
November 15th.
In mailing out notices November 15th, say, you've only got a window now anyway. You get your notice and you've got 20 days to ask for relief. If you had part-time workers that you were charged for up back to June of 82.
Senator, I have some thoughts here from the Employment Division. The bottom line on this really is that the changes that we would be making this November based upon employers asking for relief would affect tax rates not yet used. It would still create a drain, an insignificant small drain on the trust fund, to the extent that we'd be paying out monies that wouldn't be covered by monies coming in. If we went back to 1981, we would do exactly the same thing. It would be based upon a request from the employer after the November tax rates were sent out, but it would then affect tax rates that had already been used. That is really the difference, and it would create a credit to the employer or a reduction in future tax
rates. But I thought what Ms. Leonard's testimony was is that to offset that, you'd raise some other people's rates so you wouldn't have a deficit in your fund.
Roger Lent would have to speak specifically to that, but it was my understanding that it would create more than likely a larger deficit in the fund because you'd be relieving.
Well, what I heard them saying was they would array the employers, and then they would have to shift some other people up because they were lumping in. These people with good experience were bringing the rates down for a group of people. So if you gave the relief and somebody else would go up. To me, it's like when you give a property tax exemption, everybody else that's a taxpayer, the rate goes up. So you help one person out, but you got to get the money, so it's going to come from a different taxpayer.
Yeah, I would still say that that's what would happen eventually as you go into future tax years. We wouldn't do that retroactively, however. We wouldn't lower one employer's taxes retroactively and raise another employer's retroactively. But as you go
You'd
into
make it up, though, in the
yeah,
future.
Yeah, you're not going to make up what you lose in one taxing year.
Mm-hmm.
You will have to adjust your rate schedules for future taxing years to meet the adequacy level.
Mm-hmm. I guess I sort of share Senator Hand's concern. We don't know if we're talking about a small amount of money or a large amount of money. And certainly you must have some idea. You have to make these.
Senator Hendrickson, in giving employer seminars, for instance, we give union seminars and employer seminars on unemployment insurance, this question always does come up. And I would say maybe out of a group of 80 to 100 employers, I get maybe two two questions specifically about that, about employers that think that they are themselves affected by it. Now, you know, I would not want to use that as a percentage of all employers out there, however. But it does come up, and we're as interested as you are in solving a problem that we get continual complaints about, too. Our only concern is the retroactivity of going back to 81.
Also, I'd like to get some feedback on Senator Hamby's amendments that she's proposing.
Here again is a situation where we are very much aware that employers are very unhappy when they cannot get relief of charges. When they discharge someone and that person found subsequent work and was perhaps laid off and now eligible for unemployment benefits. The employer in this case is a base year employer. Could be a single base year employer, the only base year employer, could be one of many with a prorated charge to their accounts. It is true that Oregon law has never had a provision for relief of charges under those circumstances. There is a provision for relief of charges if a person quit during, in a similar circumstance, found subsequent work. But a base year employer informs us that somebody quit them and we determine it was not attributable to that employer, we can relieve that base year employer's account. Now, I want you to understand that we're saying that could have been a quit with good cause or without good cause. We do not investigate good cause in that situation. We just find out they quit, and we can relieve the charges. When you talk about relieving charges on a discharge that has never been adjudicated because the person never came in and filed a claim right after that discharge, then we would have to determine whether it was a discharge for misconduct or whether it was a discharge because of just some reason that would not be considered misconduct connected with the work, or whether it was just a layoff. We would have to do a regular adjudication interview, so to speak, such as we do now. And we estimate that in going back and picking up a cold case, something that might have happened 12 months ago, it is going to take us somewhat longer than it does to do a case that is just a very recent discharge. So our estimate on the amount of time it would take is the separation issues of most recent employment now take us 107 minutes per case. We estimated then that this kind of an interview would take 120 minutes. We just added a little bit to it because we know we've got to track down an employer who may not be around, or we've got to track down a claimant, and we've got to find information that often is forgotten over a year. If we were to do the relief of charges for a discharge for misconduct for a base year employer, our estimate is that it would cost us in the next, this biennium, 83-85, approximately 10 full-time equivalent positions, which would be a total of about $608,000. The federal government, under the FUTA tax, will not pay us for administrating this kind of a law. So the only resource we would have would be to ask for state funds if this law were to, or if this amendment were to become law.
So you're saying it would cost $600,000 in general fund money?
Yes, or from some source. Because we can't get the administrative money to do it. It is not part of the process of processing claims. It would be a special state law for a special state targeted group.
Okay.
Senator Cannon.
Who's the onus on, the employer or the employee, to prove that they are entitled to unemployment benefits?
Well, I guess originally the onus is on us to determine eligibility for benefits. In doing that, if it was a discharge, the employer must come forth with information to show that it was indeed a discharge for misconduct connected with the work. If it's a quit, the onus is on the claimant.
So the onus, if it's on the agency to prove by investigation, it'd be something you're currently already doing. Is that correct?
We are not currently investigating the cases that Senator Hanby is referring to in her amendment. No. Because what you have is a case where a person worked for an employer, was fired for misconduct, did not come in and file an unemployment claim. We didn't know anything about it. They went to work someplace else.
How are you enforcing the voluntary quits from the last session that we passed?
All right. Are you talking about House Bill 2484 from the last session?
I don't know the number. It's the one that requires an employee who quits or to work for a period of time multiplied by average weekly
right.
wage to requalify.
If a person files an unemployment claim and the last separation from work was a quit without good cause or a discharge for misconduct, they are disqualified until they have found subsequent work and earned at least four times their weekly unemployment benefit amount, and then get laid off from that job.
Well, I know that, but how is it being enforced?
We disqualify them. We interview them, find out if they should be disqualified. If they are, they can't draw benefits.
Okay, so you're already interviewing people.
That's true.
And this would not create that much difference for you.
Yes, it would.
You'd still be interviewing the person.
No. We would never interview the person that Senator Hanby is talking about under today's law or the law before the last session. We just don't ever investigate a discharge or a quit if there has been subsequent employment before the claim was filed.
Okay.
Maybe I don't understand.
Do you want to pursue that further, Senator Hanby?
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
You would not interview him in regard to his first employer, but you'd be interviewing him in regard to his application for benefits from the second employer.
That's true.
His most
recent employment is the only separation that we investigate.
And I think what Senator Hanlon is asking you, if you're already interviewing regarding his application for benefits from the job he has just been either quit or been fired from, you're in the interview process. Why don't you interview him about the second one, to where you're going to make the charge from, the one he's coming from? And I think that was your
point. That's what I'm
okay.
I'm in the process.
Well, then what you're saying is we're sitting down with an interview with a person that's filed a claim, and there is a string of quits or discharges going back through his entire base year. And why couldn't we interview him on all of those? And the question is, we don't get paid to do that. We're paid on piecework. Jeez. And if we do that, we don't have the staff to do it.
You're saying the feds wouldn't give you
the
money?
The feds would not give us the money to do any more interviews than the last separation, the one that's going to affect whether he gets paid benefits or not. Interviews on whether he's going to get, an employer will get relief of charges or not, has nothing to do with paying the benefits.
Okay. Do you have any further questions?
No. I'm kind of worried about the whole system. If we don't do any more than what we're paid to do, my son came home from picking strawberries Monday and indicated he wasn't going back out. He was going to apply for unemployment benefits. And I think under this system, he might justifiably qualify.
I guess perhaps I glossed over that a little rapidly, but when you're talking about the length of time it takes to issue a decision and have an interview, and you're talking about staff, and you're talking about the cuts that we are going to get in the next fiscal year, I can give you our budget picture from the federal government for next year, but I doubt if this committee really wants to listen to it. I'd love to tell somebody, because it is tremendous.
I'd like to hear that. I think we are faced, and we see this with some other bills that are very distasteful, about things that we're having to do. And this is a case of where employers are being unjustly treated. We have some others where claimants, I think, are being unjustly treated, in which the federal government is dictating to us, to a certain degree, calling the tune, because they control the money. And it's federal money we're talking about, and if we don't play their game, they won't give us the money.
Well, it's employer money you're talking about, Madam Chairperson, but the federal government controls it.
Yeah. Well, I realize the money is coming from Oregon employers, but they are... The federal government controls the money and tells us how we're going to use it. So that is very frustrating, particularly when we see things that are unjust, and we'd like
to
be able to...
Steam up the presses.
Pardon?
Steam up the presses.
Yeah, I guess maybe we need to be talking to our federal delegation. Okay, was there anything further that you wanted to talk about on the bill? If not, I'm going to open the public hearing and have you stay here on... 2804, Representative Leek had to go back to House Labor to vote, and he will come back. He wants to testify in 2904, but you are also signed up to testify in 2804, sorry. And did you want to comment on the bill?
Madam Chairperson, the Employment Division has no particular comments on the bill. We have no objection to the bill as it stands. Passed out by the House.
Okay, I see that you had signed up to testify.
No, I did that just for information.
Oh, I see.
If the committee has questions, we'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Okay, fine. Appreciate that. Representative Leek is here, so I'll let him make his presentation. Thank you very much. Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ed Leek, Representative District 18. House Bill 2804 is intended to increase the visibility of jobs for unemployed persons. Would require all public agencies, that's state agency or any political subdivision, to provide to the Oregon State Employment Service the, quote, timely information pertinent to all existing job vacancies over which the public agency exercises employment control and for which there will be open recruitment. Jobs which are filled through promotions, existing applicant pools, or from layoff lists will be exempted. At the request of the employer...
Is that the nature of the amendments, Ed?
Yes.
That it changes it so that it's only the open recruitment?
Exactly. The amendments to the original bill did two things. One clarified the issue of open recruitment, which was the intent all along, but was not clear in the original bill. And second, excludes the issue of the contractors from the purview of the bill. There's some problems... some apparent problems that have arisen in that regard.
So people that have public contracts would not come under this anymore?
Would not come under this at this point.
Okay, this would just be for public agencies?
Public agencies only.
Counties, cities?
Counties, cities, state, school districts, whatever. The way the system would work would be that at the request of the employer, the Employment Service would create a job order for each vacancy, screen the applicants based on their compatibility with the job duties and minimum skills, and refer the qualified applicants to the public employer. The national studies, looking at the way that people find jobs, find that the Employment Service is the second most commonly used way of finding work, and it's the second in the number of individuals placed in openings, in both cases second to newspapers, but ahead of private agencies, unions, and other placement organizations. According to legislative research, of approximately 12,000 new state hires in fiscal year 81-82, only 57% of the openings were reported to the Employment Service. And the percentage of openings reported to the Employment Service by other political subdivisions was considerably less than that, but there's no way to determine exactly what the data is.
I have a question, and I maybe should have addressed that to the Employment Division. I know having friends that work in the Employment Division, having worked there many, many years ago myself in terms of doing job placement. I don't, are they doing any more job placement over there? I thought they'd cut out a lot of their job placement. Maybe it's just their counseling services they cut out.
It's, I think you might address it to them, but I believe it's the counseling that's been reduced. They continue to do the placement.
They are still doing placement. So they do...
Yeah, well, basically what would happen was that the a potential opening would be placed on the microfiche at the Employment Division office. The job applicants would look at the microfiche. They'd find a job they're interested in which does not identify the particular agency or the particular employer, fill out a little form, give that to the Employment Division worker, who would then screen the applicant as to whether they were qualified for it. And if they were qualified, then make a referral to the hiring agency.
But it would just be another job order that they
would
create.
It would just be another job order. It wouldn't in any way impact the hiring process of the agency, except to give them better qualified people than they would get from their existing methods of random notification through the newspapers and board postings. The bill doesn't create any listings for non-existent jobs. We dealt with that with the eliminating the layoff callback and that area. Doesn't affect any non-public entities. Doesn't create any new burden on business. Does not affect promotional hirings. Does not affect hirings from union lists. It does, however, give people wider opportunities to find a job in government. It does increase the efficiency of the Employment Division in finding jobs for unemployed people. It does open opportunities for those segments of our society who have been traditionally underrepresented in government employment through the good old boy network in many government agencies that let the insiders know the jobs are there and the outsiders don't know. It does interface with existing state programs to find meaningful work for the long-term unemployed. And it does, I believe, create good public policy for the state. The only opposition to the bill on the House side came from some of the representatives of local governments who say that we think that our system of putting the ads in the newspapers works just fine, and we don't need any additional assistance in finding job applicants. I believe that that's a rather short-sighted view. I think that to have a system that can provide them with a list of pre-screened applicants will do them a great service, and will do a great service to the people who are looking for work as well. One of the great frustrations I know that I've had in the past in looking for work is having to make the rounds of every, if you want to work for government as I did in the past in the non-legislative sense. You have to visit every agency in town, every state agency in town. You have to visit every school district in the area. You've got to visit every branch of county government. You've got to visit every branch of city government. And then you still may not be assured that you've found all the openings are there that you might be qualified for. This bill would create a system where a person who's interested in looking for either just work in general or work in government could go to one place and find out where those jobs were. And so I appreciate, Madam Chair, your speedy consideration of this bill, and I appreciate your passage to the floor.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Lee? I just have one. Did you vote 294 out?
We voted 2414 out.
I see. Okay.
That's the old shell game. And you'll see the P under a different shell.
The number changed to protect the innocent.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions on House Bill 2804? Okay, we'll close the public hearing.
I want to move it out.
Do you have any problems with this bill? Okay.
No, just out of curiosity, more than anything, the amendment to the House version. I've got it now. There are amendments to it.
Yeah, it takes out the paragraph.
Yeah, no, I have no problem.
Okay. Senator Wires moves that House Bill 2804 be moved to the floor as a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Hannon. Senator Houck.
Aye.
Senator Kitzhaber.
Aye.
Senator McCoy. Senator Wires.
Aye.
Senator Brown. Senator Hendrickson.
Aye. Bill passes. Yule, Chair will carry the bill. We'll move on to 2908. And we have Ross Morgan signed up.
Madam Chairperson, my name is Ross Morgan. I'm Chairman of the Employment Appeals Board. And I will read a short statement here so that I don't leave something out if it's agreeable.
We're in pretty good shape, I think, as far as the time. Do we have one more?
Yeah.
One more bill left. So.
To make you a little bit better acquainted with who we are and what we do that you may not be familiar with.
Okay, why don't you?
The Employment Appeals Board is a quasi-judicial independent review agency consisting of three members appointed by and serving at the pleasure of the governor. One member, Pat Randall, represents labor. Jerry Butler represents management. And I, as the chairman, represent the public. Funding of this board is entirely provided by the U.S. Department of Labor through the Employment Division. No Oregon General Fund dollars are involved. Board members are paid on a per diem basis. The rate of pay is an amount equal to 4% of the gross monthly salary of a regular judge of the circuit court. For each day in which they are actually engaged in the performance of their official duties, this amounts to, if you work it down mathematically, about 20% less than a circuit court judge on a daily basis, and we're actually paid by the hour. Duties of the board members primarily consist of reading the transcript of testimony, which has been prepared from a recording of the testimony taken at a hearing before an Employment Division referee. In addition to the transcripts being read, the documentary evidence introduced at the hearing is also examined. It is also necessary to examine briefs filed by the parties, the parties being the employer, Employment Division, or a claimant. And then we must provide time in some cases for oral arguments as well. The Employment Appeals Board meets approximately every other week to deliberate the cases and then enter our decision. We have been averaging in the last 6 months about 125 cases per meeting, and we're hopeful now that things are on the rise that we'll have a few less to do. Staff for the board consists of two legals and two administrative persons. There's also a one part-time administrative person used on occasion. Members of the board do not maintain state offices, and except for board meetings, our work is performed at home or in our regular offices. This bill, House Bill 2908, clarifies the position of the appeals board as an independent review body, and because there's been some question in the past about how much control the agency had over the board. The bill as amended deals with four areas. The first is changes needed by the Employment Division to deal with some common errors so that they can more easily change their decision if they find out an error has been made. We concur with them that this is necessary. Second, we are clarifying a referee's authority on
Mr.
remand.
Morgan, excuse me.
Yes.
Are you referring to lines 14 through 17 now, page 2?
Madam Chairperson, what I intended to do was just make this short summary,
okay,
then
and then
Tom
okay.
O'Connell, who is our executive secretary,
right,
intends
well,
to go line by
statement.
Line with you an
okay.
explanation, if
right.
that is
yes,
permissible.
Thank you. Yes,
right.
it's fine.
Second, we are clarifying a referee's authority on remand and omitting a time restriction not physically possible to follow, and that's the 30-day time restriction in the old law. Next, is provides for pro tem appointments and authority of the chairperson to do more than set time and dates of meetings. Now, the change in the authority of the chairperson was at the suggestion of the governor's office. However, the change to allow for pro tem appointments was a hope on our part of some way to get some relief. As a three-member board, under the present situation, there's no way for anybody to take any time off, or you're not allowed to even be sick, because somebody has to be there to read these transcripts and make the decisions. And this allows for up to a 90-day appointment. for someone to sit in for a board member if for some reason he has to vacate the seat, and which should cost no more money because of the fact that you only get paid for when you work. The board was created in 1959 due to the dissatisfaction with the Unemployment Commission, which was made up of Commissioner of Unemployment Insurance, the Commissioner of the State Accident Insurance Commission, and an individual appointed by the governor. The dissatisfaction occurred because employers and claimants alike did not perceive they were receiving an independent review of the referee's decisions. In 1959, the legislature created an independent agency to administer the unemployment insurance program and simultaneously created an independent agency to review the decisions of the other agency's referees. Due to some of the current statutory language and authority, there still remains some doubt that the Employment Appeals Board is not truly independent of the control of the Employment Division. This perception is a result of Employment Division's authority to enact rules governing the board, even though they have not made any attempt to do so. The authority is there. And also on the control of the budget. And so that we've clarified that with them and through the governor's office, and we have no more problem with the budget control. We do not view this bill as creating any substantial changes in the way in which the law should be interpreted. The bill's only purpose is to remove all of the doubt about whether the board is an independent quasi-judicial review body and to prevent future misinterpretation of the law or misconceptions of what our role is. We would ask as well, Madam Chairperson, that questions relating to the agency's changes that are asked in this bill, that we asked Libby Leonard to be allowed to comment on those as well. Tom O'Connell is our executive secretary, and he will go through the bill in any detail that you